From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we speak with Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Nigerian opposition leader Mashoud Abiola, who died in military custody yesterday in Nigeria. Also, a new report on human rights violations in the United States, which targets police brutality. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Police fired tear gas fired into the air today in Nigeria, dispersing hundreds of protesters in Lagos after at least 14 people died in violence triggered by the death of detained opposition politician Mashoud Abiola. Protesters marched through Nigeria's biggest city, shouting war chants and accusing the military government of murdering Abiola, who reportedly died of a heart attack yesterday, though an autopsy has not been completed. Separate protests sprung up in other parts of the city after a night of violence in which 11 people were confirmed dead. We have reports that dozens of people have died in Nigeria over the last 24 hours. Meanwhile, the family of Abiola is refusing to accept the official version of his sudden death, reportedly of a heart attack, saying the timing is too convenient. One of his daughters, Hafsat Abiola, who you'll hear from in just a few minutes, says her father was in the military's custody and that anything that happened to him was its responsibility. The government says Abiola died of a heart attack yesterday in a hospital where he'd been rushed after taking ill during a meeting with U.S. officials, Undersecretary of State Thomas Pickering and Susan Rice. Nigerian officials are promising a full autopsy. However, Abiola's family says he is to be buried in the next few days, so it's not clear if a complete autopsy can be carried out. And the International Press Institute today demanded an immediate investigation by an international team of doctors into the sudden death of Abiola. In a statement released today, the IPI said the fact that Abiola apparently died of a heart attack during a meeting with a delegation of U.S. officials is insufficient evidence to say that he died of natural causes. More on this later in the show. Puerto Rican union leaders say that about a half a million workers from more than 50 labor unions in Puerto Rico have joined a two-day general strike intended to halt the government's sale of the Puerto Rico telephone company to a private corporation. Demonstrations continue across the island in front of government buildings, banks, and commercial centers. Strikers also blocked access to San Juan's International Airport yesterday for several hours. The United Nations yesterday voted overwhelmingly to give Palestinians the same rights as independent states, upsetting the United States. The Palestinians, meanwhile, called the vote a huge step towards statehood. The UN resolution gives the Palestinian Observer Mission a unique non-voting seat in the 185-member assembly. The Palestinians aren't full members, but now have more rights than other observer states, such as Switzerland or the Holy See. The new powers mean Palestinian representatives can raise issues concerning the peace process in the General Assembly, co-sponsor draft resolutions on Middle East peace, and reply on the record to speeches made at the world body. They, however, cannot vote or put forward candidates for UN committees, such as the Security Council. A Lisbon paper today quoted Indonesian Foreign Minister Ali Alatas as saying his government would free East Timorese resistance leader Xanana Gusmao in the coming days as part of a, quote, global solution regarding East Timor. But local radio said the remarks contradicted a statement to Portuguese state broadcaster RTP on Tuesday in which Alatas said Gusmao would not be freed. This news from New Delhi. An Indian judge confirmed today he'd issued an arrest warrant for media baron Rupert Murdoch for failing to answer summonses related to allegations that his Star TV satellite network had broadcast obscene films. In Washington, the Justice Department says no decision has been made on whether to appeal a court ruling that President Clinton's Secret Service guards must testify in the Monica Lewinsky investigation. In a major victory for independent counsel Kenneth Starr, a federal appeals court yesterday rejected the Clinton administration's request to create a protective function privilege to shield the guards from having to disclose what they observe on duty. The panel ruled that Secret Service officers may be compelled to testify to a federal grand jury. Starr wants them to disclose what they know about Clinton's relationship with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. And the CNN correspondent Peter Arnett went to Atlanta for a meeting today with network executives about his role in a report retracted by CNN on sarin gas used during the Vietnam War. In an interview, Arnett said, "I hope they don't saddle me with the blame. I think it's a cop-out," he said. And Democratic Party fundraiser Maria Shah, already charged with making illegal contributions to President Clinton's reelection campaign, was indicted on tax charges. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nigeria's most prominent political prisoner, Masoud Abiola, has died. He collapsed during a meeting yesterday with U.S. officials, Thomas Pickering, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and Susan Rice, the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs. The Nigerian government says Abiola died of a heart attack yesterday in a hospital where he'd been rushed after he had taken ill, though it's unclear how they know this, considering that an autopsy has not yet been completed. James Rubin, the State Department spokesperson, said in Washington, "We do not have any reason to believe this is anything but natural causes, but at least one of Abiola's children said the death was suspicious, and another said the government that had kept her father imprisoned and denied him medical care was culpable in his death." The Nigerian government promised a full, prompt autopsy in cooperation with Abiola's personal physicians. Abiola's death was the second stunning development in Nigeria in less than a month. On June 8th, General Sani Abacha, the dictator who threw Abiola into jail in 1994, died suddenly also of a presumed heart attack. Well, just a few minutes ago, I was able to contact Hafsat Abiola, daughter of Masoud Abiola, who we've spoken to several times on Democracy Now! In fact, the day after Sani Abacha died as well, on June 8th. Well, first, we began by me extending condolences to Hafsat Abiola and her family.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what you understand right now on this morning after the death of your father in Nigeria as he was meeting with Thomas Pickering, the Undersecretary of State, and Nigerian officials? At this point, what do you understand led to his death yesterday?
It's still not clear. I do know that my stepmom and my older sister, Lola, saw my dad 2 nights ago. That was the first time in several years that they would be allowed to see him. And they were panicked at his condition. They said he looked very ill. And my father said that he thought he had a fever. And they spent 2 hours with him, and they finally left him at 1 a.m. They left him at 1 a.m. of the next day, even though they came the night before. And later on that day, my father would go into a meeting with the U.S. State Department delegation to Nigeria. And according to Susan Rice, Assistant Secretary for Africa, who was in that meeting, 7 minutes into the meeting, my father requested some tea, and he started coughing, and he continued coughing, and so he got up, he went into the bathroom, he came out, he was really coughing now, and he asked for the windows to be opened and for them to fan him because he couldn't breathe, and it got worse, he collapsed. The doctor was brought in, they rushed him to the hospital, where apparently they tried to revive him, but they failed to do so, and after 1.5 hours of him being in the hospital, they declared him dead. According to Susan Rice, she was present when he started coughing, and she followed in the car behind my father's, the car that my father was being taken in to the hospital. She says that it seemed that they tried everything that they could, and from the White House, has given a statement that they believe that my father died of natural causes. But I think that they speak too quickly, because even we have not even gotten the results of an autopsy yet, which the military has agreed to conduct. But really, an autopsy must be conducted by an independent body. So right now, we're still not certain of what really happened to him.
Who will conduct that autopsy?
We've been in contact with my father's doctor in Nigeria, Dr. Falomo, and we've also been able to get the Physicians for Human Rights to agree to send a pathologist into Nigeria to conduct the autopsy. Apparently, also the Canadians and British have agreed to make doctors available in Nigeria. So we're hoping that it will be a team of international doctors plus independent doctors from the Nigerian Medical Association and not in any way state doctors. But we're hoping that the autopsy will be conducted today.
The military dictator who died a month ago of a presumed heart attack was buried immediately, according to Muslim rights. Your father was also Muslim, so when do you plan to bury him?
Well, according to the Muslim rights, really, we can bury him within 3 days. You do not have to bury him right away, but you can wait 3 days. So I think that that is what my family is hoping to do, because then it would give all of us that are in foreign countries a chance to get back home if we want to be home for the burial. Although for many of us, we're a little bit frightened, because in my case, my mother was killed in 1996 by the same military. And now it looks like, whether through medical neglect or from conscious action, the military has again killed my dad. So the idea of rushing home to place ourselves in their nest is not very, it's not in any way, it wouldn't make sense to many of us, even though we want to very much be with my father at this time. So we're trying to work everything out and see when we can, when we will hold the burial. But it certainly, I don't think it will be today.
What are you demanding in terms of the funeral?
You know, Amy, I'm so confused as to what to demand in terms of the funeral. Immediately I heard of his death, I thought, because he was the elected president of the country, that the military had long denied the people their right to self-determination by incarcerating the elected president, that a step forward now is to give him a state burial, because that is what he deserves. But upon careful reflection on that, I think that if we were to give him a state burial, which will then be organized certainly with the participation of the military, it would only give the military a chance to redeem themselves in some way. And I don't think that that's something that my family needs to do. While we don't call for anything in Nigeria at all, and we're just watching what happens now, it's not our place to give the military an easy out. And so, no, I don't think that that's quite what we're going to do. What we are demanding is that the United States and all the members of the international community stop this rush to support the Nigerian military by suggesting that my father died by natural causes. That is not clear as yet. And even if it is clear from the autopsy that it was natural causes, the Nigerian military denied my father access to his doctor in the last 1.5 years, even with General Abubakar coming into power three or four weeks ago and speaking about reconciliation and all of that. He refused to allow my father to see any doctors, any lawyers, any family members until the night before his death. So, you know, these people are not in any way innocent of this crime. They're completely responsible for his death. And the international community should take that position and take the position that these people clearly have completely earned the distrust of the Nigerian people, must withdraw from politics and allow for a government of national unity to take over the country. And the government will then be led by the pro-democracy forces.
We're talking to Hafsat Abiola, the daughter of Mashood Abiola, who died yesterday in Nigeria, the presumed elected leader of Nigeria, who has been incarcerated since 1994 by the military regime. Hafsat, I wanted to ask you about your reaction to the international community. Over the last weeks, the European Union, the Secretary General of the United Nations himself, Kofi Annan, went and spoke with your father. He said that he had retracted his claim on the presidency of Nigeria. Presumably, the Undersecretary of State, Thomas Pickering, and Susan Rice, the Assistant Secretary of State, were there asking for the same thing. Is that your understanding? And what is your response to that?
You know, in a sad, tragic way, it's not yet clear, as you know, that the information is still just coming out. But the sense that we have is that it's either of two things. For the last 4 years, the military was asking my father to renounce his mandate, and he denied it. He refused to do so. But really, they just did not want to release him. It wasn't so much the mandate. They were somehow very frightened of him, very frightened of his popularity, of what the people will do once he's released. You know, so even while they were asking him to renounce his mandate, for them, in a way, they were asking him for something that they knew he could not do, because then they would have an excuse to keep him in prison. When Kofi Annan, Emeka Anyaoku came in, seemingly unbiased, objective observers and neutral bodies to see my dad, and essentially sort of reiterated some of the comments that the military have been making all along to my dad, such as, oh, there's not a real clamor within the country for your mandate, things like that. And then they asked him to renounce his mandate. It's not really even clear that he did so. What is clear is that he said he's not naive enough to believe he can leave the prison to become president. This is what he told Kofi Annan, which was later reported, interpreted in the media as meaning that he would renounce his mandate. But that's not really clear. But what I'm saying is, when the media started reporting it as a renunciation of the mandate, the military now didn't have any reason to hold him in prison. Do you see? And that if they didn't have any reason to hold him, they have to release him. Since Abacha died 4 weeks ago, General Abubakar has been releasing people releasing them piecemeal. So he'd released about 32 people, and everybody was waiting for my father, and everybody supposed that he would release my father by last week, Thursday. Instead of releasing my father, even with what Kofi Annan said, that the man has now renounced his mandate, well, not what he said, but what his statement was interpreted to mean. At that point, the military said no, they couldn't release my father right away. They had to wait until the end of the 30-day mourning period for General Abacha. Even while they'd released all these other people before the 30-day period, but they now said, well, they have to wait to release my father. What kind of coincidence is it that the 30-day period ended yesterday, Amy? What kind of coincidence is that? And that with the end of that 30-day mourning period, they would have to release this man. Because they just did not know what to do. They were terrified at what the international response, not even the international response, because they understood that my father's issue was beyond the U.S. statements, American-British statements, that it really went beyond them. That really the Nigerian people with my father's release would define what kind of democracy we would have and what the future would mean. They knew that, so they didn't want this man out. And so, but now look at, the U.S. was going in there. I'd seen Susan Rice before she went. They were going in there to plead with my father to renounce the mandate and be participating in the new political process. But they were also going to see if they could get some sort of resolution to the June 12 crisis from the military, so as to appease the pro-democracy movement. And while they were there, perhaps innocently, possibly innocently, the Nigerian military likely poisoned my father and brought him into that meeting so that he could die in front of them, so that they could see it and tell the world it was a natural death, the military is not to blame. And that is exactly what is happening.
Hafsat Abiola, I'm looking at the president's statement. That's President Clinton's statement. He said, "I was deeply saddened to learn of the sudden and untimely death of MKO Abiola, a distinguished citizen and patriot of Nigeria." It's interesting to note here that he does not say the presumed elected president of Nigeria. He goes on to say, "I have been encouraged by the State General Abdusalam Abubakar to restore public confidence in the government of Nigeria." What is your reaction to that?
What kind of public confidence has been restored when the Nigerian people asked General Abubakar to let my father come home? And instead of doing that, he kept on stalling and stalling for over a month until now. We're now sitting down looking at his obituary. The man has died. What kind of public confidence has been restored? General President Clinton should believe now that whatever gains General Abubakar has made in the last 3-4 weeks in releasing political prisoners, all of that has been lost in Nigeria today with the news of my father's death. You know, Amy, I cannot speak too much about what kind of response in Nigeria we're going to have because of what has happened. But when many people are saying that with my father's death, that the country will certainly not ever be the same again. And I don't know what that means. We will have to see. But clearly, the military does not have the people's confidence if the Nigerian military is really working in the interest of the people, with the news of his death, they should begin to pack their bags, to move out of all political offices and move straight back into the barracks immediately.
We're talking to Hafsat Abiola. She is the daughter of Mashoud Abiola, speaking to us a day after her father died in the presence of U.S. officials who had gone to Nigeria to pressure him to give up his mandate on the presidency of Nigeria. We'll be back with Hafsat Abiola and then get reaction from another leader in Nigeria, Owens Wiwa, the brother of Ken Sarawiwa, who was executed by the Nigerian military several years ago. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come. Army, they come. Confusion everywhere. 7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular straight back.
Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular straight back.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular straight back.
That is why,
yeah.
Everybody run, run, run,
yeah.
Everybody scatter, scatter,
yeah.
Someone nearly died. Some people lost some bread,
yeah.
Someone just died,
yeah.
Police they come, army they come,
yeah.
Confusion everywhere,
yeah.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. And in the break, we played the music of Fela, also died. He is Nigerian and has been held in military custody for a long time in Nigeria. We are going to continue now our conversation with Hafsat Abiola. I spoke with her just before the show began. She is the daughter of Mashoud Abiola, who died yesterday in Nigeria in the presence of U.S. officials who had gone to see him there. I asked Hafsat Abiola if she is calling for a schedule for elections now in Nigeria.
No timetable for elections. The military cannot conduct them. The military should just return to the barracks and turn the government over to a government of national unity made up of key groups within the country, key ethnic groups, including the oil-rich minorities that have been so disenfranchised within the country and led by the pro-democracy forces. Those people can then put together what can be accepted as a credible election. The Nigerian military does not have the people's confidence in conducting elections. The last elections the military attempted to conduct in April of this year, legislative elections, had a 5-8% voter turnout. They don't have the people's confidence, and it's unlikely now that the people would participate in anything that they would put together.
Your father, Mashoud Abiola, came to the United States asking for support just before he was elected president. Was it before or after he was elected president?
After, when the military annulled the election, he came. And seeing your vice president and other people in your country, he said that your government should stop giving money to the Nigerian military. Your government gives 45% of their budget by buying of Nigerian oil, but they should stop giving that money to the military because they're really a band of and you're essentially financing thieves and thugs who terrorize the people of my country. And he asked them to stop doing that in his capacity as elected president of the country. Your government failed to do that. Your government has failed my country, Amy. There's no doubt in my mind about that. They've certainly failed my father and they've failed the people of my country. In that statement that the White House released, in those last words, President Clinton apparently said he wants to reiterate the strong relationship between the Nigerian people and the strong friendship between American people and the Nigerian people and American government essentially and the Nigerian people. But that is not true. Your government has completely failed my people. They've completely failed my people. And now my country stands at the brink of a crisis that we've never seen its type before. All because your government could not act on principle as the Canadian government did, as the Scandinavian countries did. The government could not do it. Money was just too important. Oil was just too important.
Are you calling for oil sanctions against Nigeria by the U.S. government?
If the military fails to immediately transfer power, oil sanctions must be imposed. Oil sanctions is essentially, oil is essentially the salary of the Nigerian military government. It gives them $12 billion, which they treat as their personal fortune. if they will not relinquish power to the people of my country now, in a true statement of friendship, one that we've never seen from your government all this time, your government should impose, if it has any principle whatsoever, unilateral sanctions. If it has 45% of Nigeria's oil revenues coming from the U.S. government, unilateral sanctions will be all that is needed to bring that military down. If they fail to, even at this point, perhaps the international community will be more supportive and we will get multilateral sanctions. But even if we don't, the U.S. has to make a clear statement for democracy in Nigeria.
Finally, Hafsat Abiola, you have been campaigning for your father's relief. Finally, Hafsat Abiola, you've been campaigning for your father's release doggedly. You've been speaking about the politics of Nigeria and for the pro-democracy movement around this country and around the world. Would you consider going back to Nigeria to stand for office?
To stand for office? No. You know, Amy, I feel so bad now because there were times when I would speak about my father to people and I just wanted them to have a chance to meet him. I didn't want to have to sing his praises because you only had to meet this man to understand the beauty of this man. He was from the west of Nigeria, but all over Nigeria they took him because he gave so much to every group in that country. He gave so much love, so much commitment. He understood that to become president, you have to invest in the people, so he invested in the people. This man's achievement in 1993 represented 2 decades of work to win the approval of the people of Nigeria. What is there for me to go and stand office for? You look at a man that did all that, that showed so much compassion and love, and you see what they have done to him. I don't know what to say, you know. I just feel so bad that I couldn't tell him how proud I was of him. He did, you know, I was so frightened all this time that they would so undermine his spirit, undermine his courage, that they would have him renounce his mandate and by so doing, withdraw his affirmation and commitment to the people of Nigeria. But even while I didn't want him to betray the people, I didn't want him to die in prison. And that is what we have now. The people that stand by the people of my country, people that provide leadership, are just killed. Why? It seems as if all I am saying, Amy, is that it's clear to me now that in Nigeria we are not yet ready. The military of Nigeria is not willing to accept true leaders, true national patriotic leaders, people that would really stand by the masses of Nigerians and bring our country up and develop it. They're not ready. And if for whatever reason I believe I'm that kind of person, then it will be the last thing I will do to go back in there now. When in 1996 they assassinated my mother and the U.S. began its whitewashing, saying that they have no evidence as yet that the military was involved. And today, in yesterday, they assassinated my dad. And the U.S. and the international community is again saying there's no indication that the military was responsible. No, the international support is not yet there for true leaders in Nigeria to come forward. And the military will not allow for that to happen because $12 billion is just too much of a salary to lose.
Well, Hafsat Abiola, I want to thank you very much for taking this time so soon after your father's death. And again, my condolences and all of our condolences at Pacifica to be sent to you and your family.
Amy, thank you for all the support you've given in the last few years. You've been incredible. And thank you to Pacifica Radio. Thank you very much. Please pray for my country.
Thank you. Hafsat Abiola, daughter of Mashood Abiola. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We just finished a conversation with Hafsat Abiola, and if you would like a copy of today's program, you can order one from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Hafsat Abiola on this morning after her father, Mashoud Abiola, died in military detention in Nigeria. We're now going to turn to Owens Wiwa. Owens Wiwa is a man who knows tragedy well. His brother, Ken Sara Wiwa, was a Nigerian activist, poet, playwright. He was executed by hanging by the Nigerian military in 1995. Owens himself is currently living in exile in this country. He is a student at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. We now turn to Owens Wiwa to get his reaction to the death of Mashoud Abiola.
Well, I think I was shocked, and it's very sad, extremely sad, you know, for his family, and my condolences to them. But for the country, I think we are in for some really big problems ahead in trying to model out of what we find ourselves.
I suppose it's not healthy for anyone to speculate, but do you believe that he died of natural causes?
I would think that the nature of the way he died is a little bit too convenient. Well, I cannot really say. I would wait a bit for the autopsy results.
You went through this yourself, being the relative of someone who died in Nigerian custody as the brother of Ken Sara Wiwa. Did this bring back those memories?
Yes, it did. It did. It did. But the circumstances are different, but Abiola faced the same sort of condition with Ken in that he was incarcerated for a long time, was not allowed adequate medical attention, and he was being jailed even though he was an innocent person and only wanted, you know, what the people, you know, had given to him. In that case, he was a very brave person. And dying in these circumstances, when he was almost going to come out to meet his children, it's really sad.
What bearing did Mashoud Abiola have on your struggle, the struggle of the Ogoni people?
Well, Mashoud did come to Ogoni when he was campaigning, and I did say that he was going to look into the problem and see that it is resolved amicably by dialogue. That gave us quite a lot of hope, you know, because that's what we've been looking for, a situation to talk to people so that the problems there will be addressed. So we had anticipated that he would keep his promise if he was released and given his mandate.
Have you met Mashoud Abiola?
No, I've only seen him from a distance when he came to Ogoni to campaign. I saw him maybe about 50 meters away.
Do you hold the Nigerian military responsible for his death?
In a way, yes. By denying him adequate medical attention, we must know that this is a man who was rich enough, you know, to get the best attention. 60 years in Nigeria for a man of his wealth is a little bit too early to die of natural causes. He would have been able to get himself good medical attention. And by keeping him away from his family and not letting him have access to information and to good health services, where they are indirectly responsible in that sense. But until we get the autopsy results, then we will be able to confirm whether he really died of natural causes.
There has been rioting in the streets of Lagos. What is happening in Ogoni land now?
Well, in Ogoni, people are shocked, you know, at the news. I'm very worried about the fate of the Ogoni people who have been in very bad condition in detention without adequate medical attention. It is, I can say at this point, that Clement Tutsima, who was one of the Ogoni 20, died in detention also, when he was denied medical attention. So the trend of not taking care of prisoners or people in detention is very worrying to the Ogoni people, and they are all asking about the condition of the Ogoni people, and they're very sad with the rest of Nigerians over what is happening.
Explain who the Ogoni 20 are.
The Ogoni 20 are Ogoni leaders who were detained with my brother in May 1994, and have been in detention since then, kept in very bad condition. Though they've been given bail by the court on one or two occasions, the military dictatorship have refused to give them their freedom. We believe that they are being held because of their concern and what they have been saying against the multinational oil company Shell in their role in devastating the Ogoni environment. And we seek their freedom. And we want your listeners to write to the Nigerian government and to those who use Shell oil so that they get their freedom.
What role has Shell played in the Ogoni struggle and in these 20 people remaining in jail for all of these years?
Well, earlier, for quite a long time, Shell has been given a lot of bad publicity about the Ogoni people. They did the same about Kent Sarawiwa. Recently, they have started talking about respect for human rights and have issued a statement, you know, to the effect that they should have fair trial and things like that. We see those statements. We welcome those statements, but we also notice that they are not channeled to their allies, the Nigerian military. They are only channeled, you know, to the Western audience, you know, because they want a good publicity. We would like them, because we would like them to tell the military to release those gentlemen, because two of the gentlemen actually wrote from detention that they were arrested by the Shell police, taken to the Shell headquarters in Port Harcourt, and tortured before being handed over to the regular Nigerian police and military authorities. And since then, they have been in there in jail for 4 years. So Shell do have an interest. And so we want them to play a bigger role and see that these innocent people are released to their families and not to die in jail, as we are seeing in Nigeria. Shehu Yaradua, who is another prominent Nigerian, also died in jail not too long ago. We do not want this military dictator to continue eliminating its opponents, you know, by denying them medical attention when they're in jail.
Do you see Abu Bakr as any kind of change in the military dictatorship, or just continuing where Sani Abacha left off?
Well, there's obviously a momentary change, which is normal when there is a change in personnel in the Nigerian, as the head of the Nigerian army or ruling the government as at that time. They usually release prisoners in order to gain credibility from the West. 3 to 4 months after that time, they start arresting the structures, you know, that supported Abacha are still in place. The pillars of dictatorship, the transnational companies are still there in Nigeria. The other corrupt practices that have been going on in Nigeria are still there. Nothing has changed. No decree, no bad law has been repealed. All the structures are there. I do not see that there will be any change. It's just a continuation.
Do you think that the U.S. should impose oil sanctions against the military regime of Nigeria?
I suppose that the United States and other countries should not have rushed, you know, to give the limited credibility that they have given to this dictator now. They would have waited and put more pressure for quite a lot of things, which they have passed resolution on, both at the level of the United Nations and in Congress and also in the European Parliament, to take place before they do that. And we still insist that one of the ways of ensuring that a peaceful democratic change comes to Nigeria is to deprive the military of the money with which they used to buy the weapons. And most of this money comes from oil. So there should be some sanctions on oil. And oil embargo is still necessary, or the threat of it is still very necessary in order to ensure a peaceful democratic change in Nigeria.
Do you think there's going to be a state funeral for Masoud Abiola?
I think that they will give a lot of concessions. But it will, even if they say it's a state funeral, they will not. I don't think it will be that way, formally. There will be some down-tuning of all that. But that doesn't really solve any problem, right? Estate funeral will be one of the things that the Abiola's family will ask for. That will sort of place some of the supporters a bit, but it will not solve the structural problem. Estate funeral is good, but I think that the pro-democracy group should get much more from his unfortunate death and not just a state funeral. There is more at stake in Nigeria.
Owen Zwiwa, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Owen Zwiwa, leader of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People, known as MOSOP. He is currently in exile in the United States. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Everybody run, run, run. Hey-ya! Everybody scatter, scatter.
Hey-ya!
Some people lost some bread.
Hey-ya!
Someone nearly died.
Hey-ya!
Someone just died.
Hey-ya!
Police, they come, army, they come.
Hey-ya!
Confusion everywhere.
Hey-ya!
7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away, army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them leave sorrow, tears and blood.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
Them regular trademark.
That is why.
Yeah.
Everybody run, run, run.
Yeah.
Everybody scatter, scatter. Someone nearly died.
Yeah.
Some people lost some bread.
Yeah.
Someone just died.
Yeah.
Police, they come, army, they come.
Yeah.
Confusion everywhere.
Yeah.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman again. The music of Fela, a Nigerian musician who was also kept in custody by the Nigerian military for years. That last song, Sorrow, Tears, and Blood. And one other comment. In the last, 8 months or so, three prominent Nigerians have died. Mashood Abiola, as we know, yesterday died in Nigerian custody of a presumed heart attack. A month before that, the military dictator, Sani Abacha, died of a presumed heart attack. They said that, according to Muslim rights, he would have to be buried right away and so would not undergo an autopsy. And December of 97, Chief or General Yaradu also died in custody. We will be doing more on Nigeria tomorrow on Democracy Now! But speaking about abuse of authority, we now turn to a report done about the United States. In an explosive report that was released yesterday, Human Rights Watch accused local governments and federal officials of failing to address a common human rights abuse in the United States, police brutality. The report, called Shielded from Justice, Police Brutality and Accountability in the U.S., charges that shoddy internal investigations do not hold police officers accountable for abusive acts and that criminal investigations rarely result. The study also says civilian review boards lack the funding and access they need to monitor police adequately. The report is based on research conducted in 14 cities over a 2-year period and found several problems common to all of them: unjustified shootings, severe beatings, fatal chokings, and other forms of brutal physical treatment. Human Rights Watch points out that the abuses are violations of international human rights treaties by the U.S. that the U.S. is bound to, as well as domestic laws. Furthermore, they say the abuses are a betrayal of the public the officers are sworn to serve. We'll talk about which cities were studied with Allison Collins. She's the senior researcher for U.S. issues at Human Rights Watch, and she's author of the report. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Allison.
Thanks.
So, summarize for us what you found in these 14 cities.
Well, in looking at all of these cities, we were attempting to avoid just doing a list of different types of abuses or just looking at one city and its problems. So the point of the report, as you suggested in your opening, was to look at all of these cities and the barriers to accountability for officers who commit human rights violations. We found very weak civilian review that's often underfunded or under attack by police unions. We found internal investigations that are often shoddy or biased in favor of officers. We found civil lawsuits, even if they're in the tens of millions of dollars, often have no effect on an officer's personnel record or on their complaint record. And we found that criminal prosecution, whether local or federal, is very rare, and prosecutors are reluctant to bring these cases.
Hmm. Tell us the cities you looked at.
We looked at Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis, Minneapolis, New Orleans, New York, Philadelphia, Portland, Providence, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C.
Let's start with San Francisco and Los Angeles. Tell us specifically what you found.
Well, in the case of Los Angeles, after they definitely went through a low point as far as community trust and a high point as far as perceptions and reality of racial slurs by officers, and there's definitely a sexual harassment issue within the department, and also severe beatings and so forth that came to attention with the King videotape. They seem to be slowly on the mend. I don't think it's happening at the speed many people would like, but one promising sign is they have an inspector general there now who's doing an excellent job, who is sort of a watchdog for the whole police department. She has put out 3 different reports on domestic violence at-risk officers and complaint intake, and it seems she's doing a very good job and forcing policy changes within that department. Another promising sign, perhaps, in Los Angeles is its new police chief, Parks, seems to be a strict disciplinarian, which is something that's been lacking in the department. He's pushing hard for dismissals instead of light discipline, and I think that might bear some fruit in Los Angeles. Quickly, in San Francisco, we found there San Francisco has a high ratio of shootings, police shootings of suspects, and a very low rate of prosecution for those shootings. There have been no criminal prosecutions of officers in 20 years of police shootings, and there are many shootings in San Francisco by police. It's hard to believe that not one of them has been unjustified in a criminal act, especially when you look at some cases in our report. We also found in San Francisco that its civilian review apparatus is actually working very well. It's a bit of an exception because it has a lot of power, and it is performing pretty well right now.
What are some of those cases you refer to that are serious exceptions?
Well, there are several shooting cases in the report, one where an internal affairs, so the homicide department and internal affairs investigation was very shoddy, where a man followed a man who was allegedly armed into the man's garage and opened fire with the closed garage door, trying to shoot the man, yet he'd already dropped his gun. They also followed he shot up to the man as he climbed up on his roof, and shell casings were missing, people weren't interviewed, a neighbor who saw pieces of it wasn't interviewed, and the officer was exonerated by it's a very secretive firearms discharge board that used to exist in San Francisco and after this case was abolished. But those kinds of investigations, and also the officer was allowed to stick around the scene, and there are rumors that he, you know, picked up different shell casings and so forth to protect himself. So it appeared that they were doing a very poor job. There's now a bit more transparency with that firearms discharge board that's within the police department.
Allison Collins, what did you find in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I don't think it's a secret to anyone who pays attention to what's going on here that the police department is in management disarray, or perhaps is coming out of it with the new police chief that seems to be making the right statements in any event. But the police department, let alone, you know, not really doing any policing, there's been studies about how few police officers are actually arresting people, that a vast majority of them aren't doing a whole lot, it appears. But that might be a good thing, because screening and training in the past hasn't been very good in Washington, and perhaps fewer citizen contacts would be best until that sort of recruitment is improved. In Washington, there's no civilian review board. It was abolished in 1995, allegedly for funding reasons. There was talk as recently as yesterday, the chief mentioned in an article that he might call for some reformation of civilian review. It's very important with this police department to have some sort of external scrutiny, because it has a very troubled recent past with, you know, a chief resigning and with a lot of records that are missing relating to brutality complaints that were passed from the civilian review board to the internal affairs unit. It wasn't an easy city to investigate despite being based here. I have a Freedom of Information Act pending with the Internal Affairs Bureau from 1996 that they wrote to me and said they received and that they were working on. But this department's been particularly unresponsive to requests for information, and I hope that changes.
When you talk about being precluded from or having a hard time getting information. I can only think of New York, where the mayor of New York, Mayor Giuliani, has made it very tough to get information. What about what you found in New York, this report coming just a few weeks after the civil rights trial of Francis Lavoti, a police officer who was found guilty in the civil rights, in the federal case of killing a young man named Anthony Baez, but was acquitted in the criminal trial?
Right. That actually, except for the criminal prosecution, the repeated criminal prosecution of Officer Lavoti, his case is the embodiment of what we're talking about with problems of accountability. Officer Lavoti had, depending upon reports, between 9 and 11 brutality charges lodged against him prior to choking Anthony Baez in December of 1994. His immediate superior in 1991 was worried about him and wanted him off the streets. Yet because Officer Lavoti was a union delegate, apparently higher level police officials told Lavoti's direct supervisor that they didn't want him off the streets. It's absolutely tragic that he was on the streets in 1994 because it doesn't appear he was suited for police work, and he had already committed many brutality, had been involved in brutality prior to that. Also, the case showed a lot of perjury within the police department, which is a code of silence, and perjury is a huge problem in any police department. In New York, in this case, several officers got together and made up stories about how this choking took place, and now federal prosecutors are going after those officers. I don't think that's, it's not unique to this case that officers planned to cover up their actions and to make the officers' actions look justified. I would also note that the criminal case, the state criminal case in 1996, when Lavoti was acquitted by a judge-only trial, the judge said that there was a nest of perjury, and 2 years later, the federal prosecutors said it again. In the time in between, the police department took no steps to investigate those officers, to our knowledge, who apparently lied. Other problems with police accountability in New York. One is the Civilian Review Board that is improving a bit this year. Mayor Giuliani gave a little bit more money to the review board in New York after the Louima case, and now they seem to be sustaining more complaints, and they seem to be fully investigating more cases, and that's a good sign. The bad sign is that the police commissioner continues to disregard a lot of the sustained complaints that the review board forwards to the police department for disciplinary sanctions, and that's an ongoing problem. There are a lot of other problems with New York. One is the 48-hour rule that allows officers involved in serious incidents to wait 48 business hours before providing any account of what took place. This means that incidents like Lavoti's, where officers get together and perhaps concoct stories, which they did, and in the Lavoti case, according to reports, that it means that people are able to cover things up. And any investigator will tell you waiting 48 business hours is not a good idea. That's not the way to conduct an investigation. It makes many leads go cold, and it makes gathering physical evidence more difficult. So that's another problem with New York. But they have a large accountability problem, and it really shouldn't be copied in the cities that are copying its aggressive policing tactics.
We're talking to Allison Collins, senior researcher for U.S. Issues at Human Rights Watch, author of the report Shielded from Justice, Police Brutality and Accountability in the United States. We're also joined on the telephone by Jim Fife, who is a professor of criminal justice at Temple University in Philadelphia, a former New York City police officer and author of the book Above the Law, Police and the Excessive Use of Force. Well, it's about time, Jim Fife, that a report like this was done. Does it surprise you as a former cop?
No, it doesn't. Since I've been out of policing, I've testified in probably 300 civil rights cases involving most of the departments that Allison has studied. And she confirms in most cases what I already knew to be a fact, and I think she's performed a valuable service in airing the linen.
One of the issues that Allison just raised, the issue of lying, which people know all over this country, the issue of police officers lying on the stand, concocting stories. Not only are police officers not charged and investigated for and brought to trial for shootings, but then you have a group of officers, and of course this is not all officers, but who will lie about what happened. How do you deal with that, Jim Fife?
I think Commissioner Safer in New York said that he would fire anybody who lied. He has just done that recently after Louima, and there have been some dismissals. And I think that's the only way to deal with that. I see it all the time. I just testified yesterday in a case in Philadelphia in which an off-duty police officer brutalized two old men in a neighborhood dispute. the city settled the case because they really can't defend what the officer did and or the accountability mechanisms they have in place. And the officer's lies are obvious. All his statements are inconsistent with the physical evidence. Yet here we are almost 2 years after the incident, and his case is still alive, and the police department has not been disposed of.
Allison Collins, in terms of recommendations that Human Rights Watch has made on human rights violations in the U.S., police brutality and accountability, what's the list?
We actually, the report has more than 50 recommendations, so we won't go through all of those. The ones that we're highlighting most regularly and that we'll do follow-up on in particular, one is federal aid conditionality, just as federal aid is conditioned on discrimination, on non-discrimination issues, and just as foreign aid is supposed to be conditioned on respect for human rights in the recipient countries. The billions of dollars that the federal government provides to local police departments every year should have some kind of conditionality on it relating to respect for human rights. There are a few things that should be more important than that. At a minimum, the police departments all over the country need to provide in a mandatory way data on the use of excessive force within their police departments or their sheriff's departments. It's 4 years after now that Congress called in 1994 to collect data on the use of excessive force, and there were supposed to be annual reports. It's now 1998, and there's been no such report, and it's because the Justice Department is relying on departments to report voluntarily about excessive force. It just isn't going to happen, and it isn't happening. That needs to happen. Federal aid conditionality could also be based on setting up effective early warning systems that departments actually use. This is long overdue. There are often a small percentage of officers who commit the vast majority of abuses. And if it is just a small percentage, these departments need to take care of it. And if they fear losing money, perhaps they'll take it more seriously in discipline, retrain, or counsel, whatever it takes to make these officers behave, especially the ones who are prone to misbehavior in the future, to make sure abuses don't take place. Also, special prosecutors. We talk a lot in the report about local prosecutors and how they typically work closely with officers, and they are reluctant to bring criminal cases against those officers because they have ties to them in prosecuting other criminals. And with brutality cases being difficult anyway, it's just an additional burden to have that sort of conflict of interest. So we strongly believe that each state should set up a special prosecutor's office that doesn't need to be enormous, but that would deal with police issues, police brutality and corruption cases, so that they would have a certain expertise in going after these cases, which are difficult to prove sometimes, and so there isn't that conflict of interest that you have now with local prosecutors who are very close with officers.
Unfortunately, Allison Collins, we have run out of time, but if people want to get a hold of the report, Shielded from Justice, Police Brutality and Accountability in the United States, where can they call?
Well, they could call our office, which is 202-371-6592. It's also on the web, and that's www.hrw.org. If they want to call it up, the full report is actually available on the web.
That's www.hrw.org, or in Washington, D.C., 202-371-6592. Thank you very much to Allison Collins, who is the senior researcher for U.S. Issues at Human Rights Watch, and Jim Fife, a former New York City police officer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Errol Maitland is our technical director, and Joe Gill engineered from Washington. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Special thanks to Mike Fleischman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!